Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckadelics? Paul Rudd. Paul Rudd is on the show today. This was a long time coming. We've been trying to do it. I think there was a couple times where it just didn't work out for some reason, but Paul Rudd will be here. He's got that Marvel movie, that Ant-Man movie, Ant-Man and the Wasp, opens this Friday, July 6th. We talk about that a little bit. We talk about the broader Paul situation more so, but that's happening shortly. Let's hang out here, all right? So I'm on a Netflix show called Glow, The Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, and that show premiered, they dropped it, as Netflix does. It's not a premiere per se, but all episodes of the new season, all 10, are available as of last Friday. Today's Monday. I do a show on Thursday. Did I mention that Glow would be dropping the day after the last show that I was on here in my garage, my own show? Did I talk about the show that I am a featured performer on? Premiering the next day, dropping the next day, 10 episodes. No, I did not. Was the oversight on purpose? It was not. Did I know was coming out that day? Yes. So why would I not promote it? Why do I do? And I've done that before here, you know, where I forget to promote my gigs. It's a strange phenomenon. I don't know. I don't think it's fear. I don't think it's insecurity. I think that I come out here, I'm so intent on figuring out what I'm going to say right now that if it's not written down, I forget it because I'm caught up in sitting here playing my guitar, meditating on what the fuck I'm going to say to you people. And I mean you people in a nice way. And I just forget to promote the wonderful things that are happening in my life. Okay, see, that might be it. That might be it. The wonderful things happening in my life, I forget to talk about. I forget to engage in. I forget to be grateful for. I forget to be humbled by the journey I've been on and have some satisfaction in what I've accomplished. I forget all those things. I forget what I mean to some of you folks, what the show means to you. I forget all this good stuff that I've worked for in my entire life and just fester on the shit. But nonetheless, Glow Season 2 is up. It is out. It is on Netflix. It did come out tremendously well. Everybody did a great job. I mean, literally everybody on that show did a great job. All the actors, I think we did a wonderful job. The directing, the writing, the wrestling. I mean, it's been a thrill to be part of it, and it's exciting. You know, after, you know, you shoot these things last year, October, November, whenever we did it, in the fall, and then they put it together for months, and then they put it on hold until they drop it, and then they drop it, and you're like, oh, that's what I did. That's what we all did. Look what we all did. I guess what I'm trying to point out is I'm proud of the show, I'm proud of the work that we all did, and I'm excited for you all to see it. So, if you didn't already know, Glow Season 2 is now on Netflix. It's probably something I should have said last week. Did not say it. I got an odd email because, like, I often wonder where people are at, and, you know, sort of, it's not even a substantial email, but, like, I'm always amazed. It's like in the movie Michael Clayton, which, if you haven't seen it, you should watch it. It's one of the great movies. Michael Clayton, Sidney Pollack says, people are just, you know, fucking incomprehensible. People are incomprehensible. Can that be true? It is true, isn't it? I don't think it's not so much because we can't make assumptions about human beings, but human beings in different situations will do things that you could never know. You can never know what the fuck's going on. They're incomprehensible. It's true. Whatever you think you have a handle on when it comes to other people, don't be so sure. This is a big ramp up for a cute email, but I just... just says, sometimes the oddest things make me laugh. Mark, I was listening to the Eleanor Kerrigan episode today, and for some reason, the moment where you dropped your pen made me laugh harder than anything has for days. I can't explain it. Thanks, as always, for your show. You are a voice of empathy and reason and humor, and I appreciate the laughs, even when they come from unplanned and utterly mundane events. I don't know what's up with that guy. I don't know how it hit him, but those are the laughs that I love the most. The one guy laughing at the thing that nobody else laughed at. I don't even remember dropping my pen. But it happens on stage sometimes. There's certain things where I think they're funny and I know that they're funny, but they may be awfully subtle. They may come after a barrage of other things. But sometimes I'll have a line where one person will laugh and it's the type of laugh that should be crying. It goes deep. It is unavoidable. It registered without fully even knowing what hit him or her. Love that laugh. And you're welcome, Darren. You're welcome. All right? So Paul Rudd finally is here. I was excited to talk to him. He's a sweet guy. No one's going to say Paul's a shitty guy. I don't think. Maybe there's somebody, but not to my knowledge. The new movie is the Ant-Man movie, Ant-Man and the Wasp. It opens this Friday, July 6th. But, Paul's been around a long time. He's one of those guys many of us feel like we kind of grew up with. And it was a pleasure to talk to him. This is me and Paul.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Rudd.
You know, it was really my wife and I, for our kids.
Yeah.
Really, we were thinking, do we buy an apartment?
Yeah.
Or get a house upstate?
Yes.
Yeah. It was, I think, a better call to get
the house
upstate. Yeah.
And that's like in the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you spend a lot of time up there?
As much as we can.
Yeah.
I guess.
How many kids?
I got two kids.
So, yeah, I mean, what is it, half and half?
No, it's
mostly city.
It's mostly city. And weekends,
yeah.
Hopefully upstate or, part of the summer.
Oh, that's how it goes, huh? Yeah. So you're really a city guy.
Pretty much. I mean, my kids are now actual kids.
Yeah.
So we can't, just, 13 and 8.
13?
So there was a while there we were going to maybe make the move.
Yeah.
But my son, who now is...
He's locked in.
He's like, there's no way we can do that.
Yeah.
And
not disrupt.
It just felt cruel.
Because he's got friends. He's got, he's probably in business of some kind.
Yeah, probably. Well,
at
that's,
13,
and the thing is that he says, like, we go out there, he really made me laugh. He said, Dad, I was born in this city. And they say, he wasn't even trying to make me laugh.
Right.
But he said, they say New York is the city that never sleeps. Upstate is the city that only sleeps. There's nothing to do. And he's right. There's really, that's what I love about
it. He's out at Studio 54. He's got things all night long.
He's either, if he's not at Studio 54, he's hanging at those kind of Upper East Side Dick Cavett socials.
Sure, man.
So he is full-fledged in New York City.
Yeah, he probably told you that when you had slept and he hadn't slept all night and he was sitting at the counter in the kitchen, still in his suit.
Mm-hmm, yeah. That's it.
And a little tired from the night.
Oh,
13.
Going on and on about Michael Musto.
Oh, of course.
Right,
that guy.
Yeah.
Nan
Golden.
Nan Golden taking pictures.
Yeah.
That's a rough party your kid's at.
Yeah. He's exploring every facet of New York City.
In the 1970s.
You've seen that movie Kids?
Yeah.
That's what he's living.
Oh, man.
God, I hope not. That would be my nightmare.
Yeah, I don't know. Does that exist anymore? I think.
I'm sure it's morphed into something else. But, kids in New York City is a very real thing. And I'm raising kids in New York City, which is a
right
kind of a bizarre.
It seems
thing
like
to
the
do
romanticization of you know, that lifestyle that was still around. I don't know, how old are you?
I'm 49.
So I'm 53. So, like, you know, there no one's romanticizing drugs really anymore in a cultural way. Mm. Like, when we were kids, it was sort of like, yeah, man, let's get high. Let's see. Like, I don't feel that those role models are as much around as they used to be.
Well, so, I hope not.
That's all I'm saying. I'm saying your kid's probably okay. I'm sure you got him at a good school. He's not in too much trouble.
You know, he's a good kid. They're both my kids are great. And at a certain point, you could just try and, you know, teach them as best you can and then let them go be kids.
Right. You got to separate, huh? You got to let them be their own people. And you have the other one's a girl?
Mm-hmm.
Younger.
Eight.
Yeah. Oh, man. So this is good times. This is the good times for the kids.
Yeah.
They kind of like you. They need advice, but you don't have to worry about them constantly.
Right. Well, I worry about them constantly. I definitely I did that. I've always worried about them
That's
constantly.
Why I don't have any. Yeah. I get the idea of having them causes me extreme panic.
I get it. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, but you did it. I had two.
Yeah, I had two of them.
You seem like a genuinely more stable person than I am, I believe.
I don't know. I'm not so sure about that, but I do know this. I was really nervous about having the first kid.
Yeah.
For a myriad of reasons, several of which I think are probably ones you think about.
But then you have to make sure they're breathing all the time. But they're supposed to just do that, you know, and then
they do kind of do that.
Yeah.
They do that on their own.
The cramp, they're just laying there in the other room.
Right.
Is it okay?
I don't know. It's weird. It's weird when you leave the hospital with a kid because you feel like you're doing something that's just not supposed to happen. As soon as they're born, they're there for a couple of days and people who know what they're doing are monitoring the situation.
Right.
But then they're like, okay, here sign this, and then off you go. And you're like, what? How?
Is there a booklet?
Wait a minute.
When are you coming with me?
But when we had one, then I thought, well, you know, I'll have six.
Yeah.
Once we had one, but then we stopped at two.
Yeah, no, you don't need six.
Well, I just, my immediate thought was I want them to have somebody to kind of defray medical costs with down the road when both, you know, my wife or I are in the home.
So you're looking ahead.
I'm looking ahead.
So you just wanted at least two.
Yeah, I want at least two so that...
One of them at least will have the bread to put you up somewhere.
So one, so that one's like, oh, I can't just foot this whole bill. And two, that they'll have, you know, at least somebody that they can kind of commiserate with.
Sure, but you never know how things are going to turn. I mean, you know, you're hoping both will stay on board. One might be like, oh, fuck them.
Oh, yeah. No, like, that's it. I'm out of here, and I'm never talking to any of you again.
Yeah, that's why I think if you have many, your odds are better.
That's just it.
You're going to have the one bad egg.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
And so, I think even the greatest sports teams had one guy that was on the bench.
The bench the whole time.
Yeah, you know, it's all right to one that maybe goes and finds their own path.
Yeah. So you're here, you're doing the promotion for the Ant movie?
Yeah.
Ant-Man.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you guys with the superheroes, see like that look? That's sort of like, I've got to do that.
Well, no, it's not that. I think there's just something... so artificial and weird. Like I'm excited to sit here and talk to you and this, is why I'm in town.
No, I know, but I'm not saying we have to talk about that. But I mean, I do think it's interesting because I had Brolin in here a couple weeks ago, and you know, his sort of like you guys are aware of the movie you're doing,
right?
And there is like I imagine in some way you have to bend it into like something fun and exciting and something you can get behind, even though there's part of you that's sort of like, it's a superhero movie, you know?
Yeah. Well, I feel that with all things.
Yeah, really?
I mean, it's part, you know, there are some things that I get more excited about than others.
Yeah.
But it is, you go around, you have to talk about it, and essentially...
Oh, the selling part.
The selling part, which I've never really been... very, very good at. It's easier when it's also something that I believe in, but yeah.
But you're not, you know, Brolin's like, you know, he's all distorted and weird looking. Like you can't, you know, he's like half a monster. You're like just the guy.
Yeah, but I'm also sitting on an ant.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, so that's your price to pay.
Yeah, but
that's
your cross to bear. I do love it. It's been a really great experience. It's been super fun.
It has.
Yeah, and completely different, obviously, than anything else in my life.
I mean, I just can't imagine what the arc of it, though, when you're like doing Shakespeare in the Park in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, whoever thought that this would be that you'd be wearing these kind of tights?
It's true.
You know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess you just look at it as an acting job when you, I mean, it's obviously it's a great opportunity. It's financially lucrative and kids love it. There's very, you know, there's not too many people that are going to be standing on the sidelines going, yeah, they fucking sold out that guy, you know?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's always was my greatest fear. I would hate to be one of those people that would be considered someone who sold out.
Yeah, what does that mean anymore, though? How does one do that? Can you name one?
I think it's basically going against your own sense of what you know you find worthwhile and worth doing. But it is silly. But every job is acting is silly. The whole
kind
thing
of
is
right.
The whole thing is just kind of weird.
Yeah, I mean I've been doing more of it lately, and I start to realize that the, you know there is an element of getting away with something to acting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, like, yeah, yeah.
Once you figure it out, or if you're lucky enough to have the knack for it, like once if you're lucky enough to work, there are definitely days where you're on set going like, this is fucking ridiculous.
For sure. Especially you walk outside and you see what other people are doing for real work.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just think, I scored.
Yeah, and you can only justify it up to a certain point. Like, it is real work. I have to sit there and do that scene 9, 10, 20 times.
Yeah.
You have to do that.
It's hard. You know, being an actor is really hard.
Hard sell, huh? It's a hard sell. But, like, you know, you have a fairly oddly thorough Wikipedia page that, like, see, because I sometimes look at these things. And like in the early life segment, I almost thought maybe I should make sure, maybe you should check this to make sure it's not someone being funny. It seems very, very convoluted. There's Ireland involved. There's England involved. There's Russia, Belarus, Poland, Jews, British. A lot going on in the first paragraph of your Wikipedia page.
I don't know what it says. I haven't checked it out. But a lot of those European countries, they go back from before I was born.
No, I know that. I know, but I know that there's.
I spent any time in Belarus.
My family's from there too. I found out.
Really?
Yeah, but I didn't even know you were Jew.
Yeah.
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 You know, you pass, man.
What's that?
Was that the plan?
I have no plan.
No plan. But like, where'd you grow up?
I mean, I grew up. I was born in New Jersey.
Yeah, me too. Like what part of Jersey?
Palisades Park I lived in. I was born in Passaic, but I lived in Palisades Park, which is basically you cross the George Washington Bridge.
Fort Lee. Kind of,
yeah.
It's right by Fort Lee.
That's right.
My aunt lived there. I remember the Palisades Amusement Park before it got taken away.
Yeah, I kept hearing about that. I think it was taken down, I think, right before I was born. Or maybe right around the time.
Right around the time, yeah. I bet you were born. Yeah, I remember going there once. It seemed, my recollection, it was like literally in the cliff. Like it was right there at the edge of it.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's where you grew up, Palisades Park?
Well, I lived there until I was about five, five and a half or so.
Any recollections of looking at the bridge? It must have been like, you know.
Yeah, I remember always going into the city because it was 10 minutes
right
away.
There.
And we'd always cross the George Washington Bridge. And that we would, both my sister and I would always say, we're going across the George Washington Bridge. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized that was what it was actually called. I thought that was just something we made up.
Yeah, it took a while to, yeah, wow. Yeah. But it's good that you didn't think they took it from you and renamed the bridge.
That's right, yeah. Who coined it first?
Yeah.
So I remember certainly going into the city, and I remember life in New Jersey and had family in New Jersey.
Humid, it's humid.
Yeah, and then moved to Kansas for about a year.
That's wild.
A couple years, a year and a half or so.
Why is that? Why? But do you remember, like in your childhood, just curiosity, I don't know why. Do you remember, like, in childhood, New Jersey, Jewish, do you remember melon and tomatoes and sodas and stuff and fruit involved? Summers, New Jersey?
I remember certain... I remember certain things with, like, the corn being very good.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and summer... some of the summer... I never liked the tomatoes, so I never ate them.
Right, but you remember them,
but
right?
I remember the food being a certain kind of way. And
people talking about it.
Yeah, and then moving around, as a kid, I discovered foods in other parts of the country.
Did you ever go down the shore and get, like, steamers or anything? Clams?
No, I never did any of that. I never was kind of old enough... And then also because both my parents are from London.
Yeah. Oh.
I don't think that they ever even.
British Jews.
Knew some of that stuff was going on.
They were British Jews.
British Jews.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've only met a couple.
Oh, yeah?
I know they exist. And they've been around a long time.
Yeah.
But they're baffling to me.
There's I have friends that are British Jews, and they have said it was tough in a way to be Jewish and British, that it was there was a high anti-Semitism kind of
within you,
within themselves.
Yeah. I bet you that's true. Like Bob Hoskins, it was one of the first guys I realized was a British Jew.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. But like, what did they bring with them? Because Jersey Jews, like East Coast Jews, American Jews, very specific kind of thing, give or take a few things. What did the British Jew, what's a British Jewish thing that you grew up with?
I mean, I didn't grow up religious. I didn't go
Who
to,
does? But yeah. You're Jewish.
I'm Jewish, but I mean, we celebrated Christmas. So, you know.
Well, that's really pushing
it. That's a little.
We did that a couple years ago.
Did you?
Yeah, sure. My mom liked it. She likes the lights.
Yeah, I would always say, we're not supposed to do this, right?
Yeah.
And they would say, we celebrate for the Santa side of things.
Exactly. Yeah.
So there was probably always that assimilation. It was also a British thing. I think that maybe my mom celebrated it growing up as a kid.
Right.
But I don't know.
Yeah.
It certainly was a part of our lives. And if you are, you are.
Right.
I was bar mitzvahed. I still, you know.
You do a thing? You light the candles?
I mean, I did. Yeah. My mom would do it. My mom was into it.
Yeah.
There was a time, I think, early on when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we didn't really go to synagogue all that much.
Sure.
All that much, I mean, like barely at all.
But you had to learn to sing the songs for the bar mitzvah.
And I went to Sunday school a couple of times.
Yeah.
But there was, I think at this time, my mom was saying, what do you think, Mike? That was my dad.
Yeah.
Are we going to send our kids to Sunday school?
Yeah.
And his response was, kid's got a good sense of himself. He doesn't need that shit. And so I never was raised very religious.
Yeah. No, but it's usually a cultural thing, which that's the interesting thing to me.
Yeah.
Is that because they were British and you didn't grow up with that kind of like first or second generation Jewish experience, East Coast thing, that the actual cultural experience was not the same.
Well, the thing is the cultural experience, regardless of where you are, and I've described it this way before, which is it's kind of in the marrow of your bones.
Right.
And while we were not religious, I think that we all identified as Jews.
Yeah.
And my dad, who didn't really believe in any organized religion,
sure,
didn't really, I think, believe in a God or anything like that.
Right.
So it was never, that was not a part of my life growing up.
Right.
At the same time, was fascinated with Judaism. Couldn't, there was always a Hitler documentary on in the house.
Yeah.
And and he was very pro-Israel and proud to be Jewish.
Sure. Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. You know, it's not, you know, if you don't look, if no one teaches you how to use God, what, you don't, you know, you're not going to use it. But it doesn't, you know, but you are taught that you're a Jew.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're a Jew.
But I don't know. I mean, right. If no one teaches you how to use God, I think some people probably find it as a kid in their own way.
Yeah, maybe you can find it, but I mean, I think it's got to be, I don't know, you know, like later in life, you know, the wheels have really got to come off.
Hmm. to really embrace it.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that's does seem to be the time when people find them.
Yeah,
but
man.
Have you found
him?
No, I know.
But what are you doing with your kids?
Kind of the same thing.
They got pretty good sense of themselves.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
It's a tough thing to kind of, you know,
navigate.
And like my son was just bar mitzvahed.
You did it.
We did it.
Yeah.
And it was really.
So you're done. You did it.
We did it. It was really mellow.
Yeah.
And it was just like a kind of a small group. And he said that, look, I'll do it. You know, all of his friends are doing it.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that there's something to be said about participating in something that is thousands of years old, that gives you a sense of sanity and something continual.
Tradition.
There's something to it.
Yeah.
There is something at least comforting to that.
Yeah.
When my grandfather died, I remember it was a year later, it was the unveiling of his tombstone.
Yeah.
And I was there, and everyone started putting a rock on it, and I didn't realize that was a thing you did.
Right.
But my mom did it, and then I did it, and
you gotta go take a rock off another tombstone.
Yeah, but that's just it. We were in a rockless cemetery. And I remember in that small gesture thinking, wow, this is pretty crazy. People have done this for a very long time.
Yeah.
And there's something good about that.
Sure. You know, yeah, because it's a sense of history.
That's right.
Yeah, which, you know, is what we're being chipped away at.
And that makes us feel sane and probably puts our own importance in line of where it actually is, which is minimal.
Right. I think that's good. I think that's good. So maybe that's the lesson you pass on.
Well, he said, look, I'll do it. And I said, here's the reason why you should do it. I said, because later on, you know, you might find something from this down the road. It will affect you in ways possibly that you might not predict. And two, there's something nice about being around other Jewish people maybe later on when they're talking about their bar mitzvahs.
Yeah.
You won't feel self-conscious and say like, oh yeah, I didn't have that.
Yeah.
He said, look, I don't believe in certain aspects of this and as far as a God and all this. And he's 13, and I couldn't really debate him on a lot of it. I'm like, well, yeah, no, I get that.
Right, right. He said to you, like, I was hanging out with Lou Reed the other night, and we were having a discussion.
Yeah, no, we were. I was
up all night.
I was up with David Byrne, Lou Reed, Debbie Harry, and Tom Verlaine.
And the God thing came up.
And we were just like, you know what? Let's just check out the Ramones and go all night. And this is just not something I'm ready to deal with. I'll meet you at the factory.
Well, that's good. Those are interesting conversations. It must be interesting that because I don't know how attentive my parents were in doing those conversations.
Well, I mean, I don't think that these are conversations that I instigate.
No,
and
I know.
I don't think that they happen actually with too much frequency either.
Right. No. It's one or two. Yeah. Just like you remembered, what your dad said.
Yeah.
And then,
Well, I mean, this is it. I never, there was a time, I think, in my early 20s when I was really having this kind of spiritual and existential debate and reading books and thinking about things.
Oh, yeah? With yourself?
Yeah. And I had, had a buddy of mine, I think post-college, a friend of mine who had died, and I was dating a girl who was really into kind of new age past life stuff. I was like, all kinds
rocks
of stuff.
Rocks and smells.
Eagle feathers and crystals. Mm. But anyway, I remember having a conversation with my dad once who we had gone through a particularly rough period when it came to finances and everything. And my dad was feeling pretty, I think, in life.
You mean as a family?
Pretty cynical and beat up. But I said, Dad, we never grew up with any of this stuff. And, you talk about being Jewish, but like, do you believe in God? Do you believe in anything? And this is when he did tell me, I don't really believe in any organized religion.
Right.
I'm interested in Judaism from the historical perspective and that it's a series of, it's with the laws of the land.
Yeah. Right.
There are aspects to it that I think make sense, which is enjoy your life, try and acquire knowledge, and but really, all I worry about is treat people the way I will want to be treated, and the rest will take care of itself if there is anything else. And he goes, that's all I think about. And that's the way I think I feel too.
But was that the beginning of your existential crisis, or was it?
That's what kicked it off.
Thanks, Dad. Now what do I do? That's sort of interesting. So you like, well, let's go back. When you grew up, where'd you do most of the growing up?
Most of the growing up, I feel like the crucial years for me were in Kansas City. Because I went from New Jersey to Kansas to California for about 3.5 years and then back to Kansas City. My dad used to work for TWA Airlines, and TWA's hub was in Kansas City.
Wow.
So
I remember TWA.
Yeah. And that's why we moved.
Yeah.
So I would say from the age of 10 to 20, I was in Kansas City.
Kansas City, Missouri? Kansas City, Kansas.
But about 10 minutes from the state line.
Yeah.
People,
aren't there two Kansas Cities?
People always think that, but there's really one Kansas City.
It just happens to
sprawl over into both sides. There's a street called State Line Road, and that's the border of the two states. And so on the left side you're in Kansas, on the right side
Kansas City, right? Yeah, that's the Midwest. That is the definition of the Midwest.
Yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm.
and you're a British Jewish family in Kansas City.
Right.
Are you like, what is growing up there like? What is inspiring about it? Because like now I don't, you know, I was it ever in any way progressive or, you know, interesting?
Yeah, I think that it was. It was a nice place to grow up, and I liked it okay.
Yeah.
I think we all have these general ideas of what places are like.
Sure.
And certainly people have an idea of what Kansas is like. And yet in Kansas City, there are many aspects to living there, mm-hmm. and people that you meet and the kind of sure. progressive thought that are in contrast with what right. people's general opinions of that state might be. So I found some, you know, pretty good friends. There were actually other Jews. None of them went to my school.
Yeah.
But I heard about them.
Yeah.
I heard that they were in town.
The mythical Jews.
But honestly, what I remember kind of when I first got there
yeah.
was the things that a kid would notice,
sure.
which is they talk differently. Like in New Jersey, I remember everybody says orange.
Uh-huh.
And then when I got to Kansas City, everyone said orange.
Yeah.
And then when I got to California, everyone said, oh, it's hot, you know, or that's rad. And then in Kansas City, everyone said, that's excellent.
Yeah.
And so like these were kind of the big differences that I really noticed between states, and that you couldn't get OP shorts or Vans in Kansas.
That's the big one.
Yeah, that was, by the way, that was the biggest one when I was 11 years old. Yeah. And so
you wanted those OP corduroy shorts?
So badly. I had a bunch, yeah. but you just, you know, I yeah. was so, I would get so excited uh-huh. if in Kansas
yeah.
I saw somebody wearing Vans or OPs.
Yeah.
I'd go out to go like, are you from California? Like strangers. And you know, yeah. this was pre Zappos.
Yeah. yeah, sure, man.
And I, yeah, I had like a weird kind of unabashed enthusiasm with like anybody that was had anything like kind of from California,
right.
which I had just come from. The same thing, if anybody ever had some kind of snack that I could that you could only get in London, you know, like Roundtree fruit gums or something, I would freak out. And I think that it was kind of some sort of deep-seated longing to be where I had just come from, because I did feel a little bit like an island, you know,
or stranded.
A little bit, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, but you, right, because in your memory, you'd been in big places before.
Yeah.
And now it's sort of like, are we cut off?
I didn't even have really kind of a grasp of it. As a little kid,
yeah.
you know, we traveled a lot because my dad worked for an airline.
Right.
My parents were both born in London.
Yeah.
I'd already lived in three states before the time I was in.
And you were going back to London occasionally?
All the time, and traveling with, you know, my dad would have some kind of job thing, and so we'd travel with him, and then so I, you know, my worldview was pretty big as a kid, but I didn't realize that that wasn't the norm.
Right.
And so when I would meet other kids, and I would say, you know, where are you from? And they say, I'm from Kansas. And by the way, they'd be 9 years old.
Right.
So I'm from here.
Yeah.
I'd say, wait a minute, you're from here? You were born here? Well, what about your mom and dad? It's like, oh yeah, they were born here too. And I was like, that was like, you're a Martian.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's not even possible.
You got to get out.
But it wasn't even that you got to get out. It was even, it was more of just a bizarre idea
yeah.
that somebody could actually live in the place that they were born. I didn't think that was I didn't understand that's what most people did.
Yeah, I think that I relate to that, because I, like, if I think about it, I was so dug in family-wise in New Jersey, because both my parents were from there, and I'd go back all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived there when I was a little kid, but when I was in New Mexico, the idea that people had lived there felt, you know, like, or for generations, it was sort of weird and backward and seemingly kind of limited.
Yeah.
But, you know, they don't think that.
You know, your reality is your reality.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you had that same, I mean, obviously, New Jersey to New Mexico.
Yeah, and Alaska for 2 years.
Wow, Anchorage. You really, I thought I had it diverse.
But I never went to Alaska, because my old man was in the service, like, you know, and then but New Mexico was a big shift. But I always was very connected to the family back east. And,
right.
you know, I always, which becomes a point of pride, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, I'm going to go to New York.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we would go back too, because my, you know, my dad's brother, my aunt and uncle and cousins, and my grandparents were still in New Jersey.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
And it was like, that was an amazing thing. I remember when I was in high school, I made my friend David go with me to New York. I'm like, let's go. I got to show you New York, because he'd never gone. Mm-hmm. He'd never been there. And we did that. And I remember we bought Familari shoes because they gave us 3 inches, and we had fake IDs, and it was a big deal. We were going to go get a beer.
Nice.
Like at Hamburger Harry's or somewhere. Some shitty place. We're just sort of like, we're going to do it.
You planning it?
Yeah.
Talking about it for a long time.
A pitcher of beer.
Oh, man.
And they bring it, and you're like, fuck yeah.
Yeah, we did it. We pulled it off. Yeah. It's the best.
It went something
really,
like that.
That kind of excitement over something like that.
Yeah. Just sitting there, just kids getting drunk.
What's better?
Nothing. No, it's all behind us. So, so you're in Kansas. And, well, I don't know, like, I guess I was being presumptuous or making assumptions about, you know, what you like, because like, when you bring up OP and Vans, like, I remember that.
Yeah.
I had a friend who's very into OPs, and then I got into them, and then I remember the corduroy shirts and the pockets were a certain
And you'd
way.
Let your boxer shorts hang below.
Under the cuff?
So that your boxers were kind of hanging out a little bit below the shorts.
Oh, yeah, I didn't get that far away.
That was serious. That's when you wanted to up it up, you know.
That was it?
Yeah, well, yeah.
But I remember the shirts, the t-shirts. Yeah. But I don't know if I was into them as much as my friend was into them, but because he was into them, I got into them.
Right.
But you were all in. But you, like, weren't a punk rock kid or an art kid necessarily.
I don't know. I liked... I remember when I moved to California the first time, I thought it was weird. Every kid has a skateboard.
Right.
That was a whole new kind of experience. Mm-hmm. And then I got into kind of skateboarding and BMX.
Yeah.
But really peripherally.
Could you do pulls?
No.
Hmm.
No. Bunny hops.
Yeah. That's about it.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't get into it. I didn't get into it where I was really proficient.
Risking your life.
Yeah. But I was like, I'd read magazines and learn about zap pads.
You didn't need a helmet, though. Did you have a helmet?
I didn't have a helmet.
Oh, so you were.
And Red Lines and Mongoose and all of those.
So you had the shit, but you
I had the shit.
But you didn't walk the walk.
I would have liked to, but by the time I think I discovered it, I'd already gone to Kansas, and that stuff, you couldn't find it.
Right.
But then I started kind of getting into, you know, as a young teenager, kind of weird... new wave kind of stuff and some punk music and then some Euro kind of keyboardy stuff.
But because you grew up in the Midwest, like I grew up in Albuquerque, you know, you're like not unlike that movie. What is it? You're with Jason Segel, the Rush movie.
Oh, I Love You, Man.
I Love You, Man. Like, that was part of my life. Like, you know, those bands, like, you know, you had to meet somebody who was, or go somewhere to turn you on to alternative shit, or you're going to be locked in with Rush and Bob Seger, that Foreigner, and
by the way, all of those songs, all of those artists are playing on Kansas City radio right now.
They're playing everywhere right now.
Yeah, but I mean, that's all still
Tom Petty.
Yeah, that's. I had a theory about Kansas City.
Yeah,
that is
Kansas.
Kansas City, Kansas, and Missouri.
But like the band Kansas.
Oh, the band Kansas.
Carry on my wayward son.
There'll be peace when you are gone.
Yeah.
But I always said that you will be able to find Bad to the Bone on the radio at any...
Bad to the Bone.
One time.
Really? Thoroughgood?
Oh, yeah.
But that was sort of what you were up against. That's what you were...
I didn't like any of it.
No?
I really rebelled against all of that kind of stuff.
Really?
I didn't like it. No.
OP was your rebellion?
Well, this was a little post... This was a couple years after that. I was like, hey guys, I'm sorry, I'm listening to Depeche Mode and Howard Jones. You guys can take your Kansas and your...
And look your, at my skinny tie.
And your Uriah Heep.
Uriah Heep. That's going back even further. okay. So your yes. Take your yes.
Take your yes.
I say no to your yes.
Yeah.
But you went new wave. That's good.
I went real new wave.
Any Bowie? Little Bowie?
Yeah, I like Bowie, but I was never an aficionado. Like, I don't think I ever quite discovered the brilliance.
Sure. Well, who were you aficionado of? I mean, Howard Jones can only go so far.
Yeah, can only go so far.
Yeah.
I really I really got into like kind of the Smiths and REM.
Oh, okay.
But then before that, Depeche Mode, huge. Mm. My first concert was the Stray Cats.
Sure.
And I loved...
that was a good few albums.
Yeah. I loved... I really liked NXS.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not judging. You're looking at me like, what are you going to come at me with that? What do you got to say about that, Mary?
I would say Depeche Mode...
Was it?
There were a few years there
where
it's like, if you wrote Depeche Mode on a piece of paper, I would offer you money for it. Because I just like anything Depeche Mode, just I want to buy it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That was it, huh?
I
What was their big hit? I'm trying to remember. I know I got a Depeche Mode record in there with the older records. Like,
Well, People Are People, I think, was probably their big hit that really...
But REM, like, that was something. That was a time.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
So when does acting become an interest to you, really?
Well... I suppose in the abstract, it was always an interest,
Do we need to deal with abstracts?
Let's deal with abstracts.
In the abstract, it was always like,
in the abstract, because I didn't realize that this was the kind of thing somebody might be able to do.
I hear that a lot. It's kind of interesting. Well, Why would you know? Yeah.
It wasn't, no one in my family had ever done anything like this. I was living in a place where this kind of thing.
What about siblings? You have them?
I have a sister.
How old? Older than you?
She's 2.5 years younger than me.
Okay.
And so I think that, you know, the idea of being an actor wasn't something that I really ever wrapped my brain around until I was maybe 16 or 17 and somebody had suggested it.
Uh-huh.
But I did kind of gravitate towards comedians and comedy at a pretty young age. And maybe it's because I moved around so much, or maybe it has nothing to do with any of that, and I just really liked comedians.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, like, comedians make sense of things. I think that kids who like comedians, like, who are the comedians you like?
Well, I loved Steve Martin.
Yeah.
You know, when those albums came out, I think those were seminal to, you know, a generation of comedians, for sure. I used to listen to Mel Brooks and the 2000-Year-Old
Man. 2000-Year-Old
Man, with my dad.
Yeah.
I loved George Carlin as a kid. And,
yeah.
And to this day, probably consider him maybe my... favorite.
Yeah, did you ever get to work with him or meet him?
Never met him. Mm. No, never worked with him.
Well, yeah, because I think for me, like when I look back at my compulsive sort of interest in comedy was because they seemed to have a handle on things. These, you know, and it made you laugh and they made sense of things and they made you look at things differently. And, you know, it was like, you know, when you're young or you're a little vague on what your identity is or who you're going to be, you know, these guys seem to know what they're talking about.
Who was it for you? Who was it that...
Well, I mean, like when I was a kid, I liked I liked Jackie Vernon and, you know, Don Rickles and Buddy Hackett because my grandmother, he was, my grandfather liked slapstick, but my grandmother liked those old guys. And then like later, you know, Woody Allen became important. And then I had all the Carlin records, Cheech and Chong records. I had the Steve Martin records and SNL for, you know, that thing. But yeah, I mean, I mean, Richard Pryor, that when I saw that Richard Pryor live in concert, the first movie, when I was in high school, like 14 or 15 years old, I was like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
Like me and my friend Dave went to a movie theater to see a stand-up comedy movie, and it was insane.
I know.
To watch it was insane.
It was the best.
Yeah.
You're right. It did tend to make sense of things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why I got into it, I think. It was innate. Like, how do I get a handle on this shit? You know, it's like, well, make it funny.
Yeah.
He figured it out.
And it's interesting to see how your interest in it and who you're kind of drawn to starts to change.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I it's funny, like when I hear Steve Martin talk about those years and how he
unhappy
just,
he was.
Or how he doesn't feel like it was that funny or what, you know. I think even as a kid, I understood the, on some innate sense, some part of me of... that it's more than silliness, that the deconstruction and kind of philosophical experience that it actually was in silliness. Same thing with Monty Python.
Yeah.
You know, we would watch that.
Sure.
Obviously, because of British parents. Like as a kid.
On PBS, you'd have to watch it.
I loved it.
Yeah.
And so I think there was that first thing of, oh my God, these are grown-ups acting insane. Like I've never seen such silliness out of grown-ups.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and I would love like shows like Make Me Laugh and all, and, oh, yeah, and then getting into
Bobby Van, Make Me
Bobby,
Laugh.
Yeah, and
Bruce Man Baum.
Bruce Baum and Bruce, yeah, and Gary Mule Deer, yeah. And I would still go down the rabbit hole of, you know, Joe Bolster and and all of those comedians. And then we got HBO, and all of a sudden there was, what is this Robert Klein special? And,
oh, yeah.
And,
you right. know, there's nine of them. Another one. He still can't stop his foot.
He's at Yale.
Yeah. I mean, so you loved it.
And then, you know.
I remember seeing Steve Martin. I saw Steve Martin on that first tour.
Oh, wow.
After the first record, it was at the pit at the basketball stadium. I remember seeing him.
You did. What was that like?
Well, it was great because it was big, you know. Like, he was not, if I look back on it, he's obviously not an influence or necessarily even somebody that, you know, I put in my top 10.
Mm-hmm.
But that he was something at the moment. It was like, you know, he was a rock star. Like, he was sort of like, hey, let's get small. Like, I had the records, but like, I didn't get the same out of them as I got out of Carlin.
Sure.
Where you got a history, an identity, a critical
culture. He's the guy, I think, that I probably think of more than anybody, and of having more importance to in my life, even as an adult. Uh-huh. I think the way that I approach certain things in my life, he was our greatest social commentator. There are many times where I think about what's going on in the world,
yeah.
I think about what he said.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always thinking about his bit on saving the planet.
Uh-huh.
He said, you know, I love people. I hate groups, but I love people. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, my interest in comedy was starting to veer. I mean, in my early 20s, got really into Andy Kaufman, and then turning into kind of the anti, more performance art aspect.
This
of
is
it.
During the existential crisis period.
I think it was probably. I remember him as a kid and thinking he was really funny on SNL.
But you didn't realize the scope of it.
Well, I remember watching him on Letterman.
Sure. With the wrestling thing?
With what?
During the wrestling period?
Yeah. I remember the wrestling period and thinking, well, this is kind of weird.
Right.
And yet, feeling like I think he's doing something to provoke people and not even understanding what that was.
Yeah.
Like, there was something intrinsically interesting about it.
Right, right.
And then I really got into that.
Yeah.
And his whole thing about getting just reactions and
hearing
stories about some of his early routines about, you know, coming out on stage, eating potatoes, and then going to sleep.
Yeah.
And that was his act. And thinking, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And
unless you're there.
Unless you're there.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, if you're there about an hour into that, you're like, what's happening? Do we leave?
Having an intellectual appreciation of it and an emotional annoyance.
Yeah. No, so you're in your teens, someone says you should get into acting, and this stuff's all coming into your head, and you know, and basically we were talking about you realizing that maybe it is a profession if these grown-ups can act this silly on some level.
Right.
That, you know, there's an avenue there.
Well, I think that when
did
I...
Did you do stand-up? Did you go see stand-up?
And I used to see stand-up whenever people would kind of come through. I saw some really cool shows. I saw Bill Hicks in a room of about 20 people.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
When you were in high school or later?
College? High school.
Really?
Yeah. And I saw Carlin a few times in Kansas City.
Yeah.
I saw Jay Leno.
Yeah. He was good, wasn't he?
He was great.
Yep.
I loved it.
You thought about doing it.
I think I thought about doing it for a little while, but not seriously. Again, it was something that I also really liked art and drawing. And it seemed like, well, who's a comedian?
You drawing?
I was trying to.
Yeah.
I think that naturally I started to gravitate towards speech class, you know, public speaking class, and there was a radio and TV class in my junior high and then high school.
Yeah.
I used to make these little short movies and do, they called it in Kansas City forensics.
Uh-huh.
It was like speech tournaments and stuff. But I was also hugely influenced, I'd say, comedically, and just by Letterman. Letterman was the guy.
Right.
And so a lot of the stuff that I was doing in high school with those with a video camera in that class, I think was Letterman-esque or trying to be.
Sure.
But I would make these kind of these shorts and things to show on our school TV channel. And
yeah.
My next door neighbor said, "Have you ever thought about being an actor?" Because I was also doing, you know, like these speech tournaments.
So you're kind of like hosting things and like kind of like with that, with a kind of Letterman approach.
Well, they were more just kind of, yeah, you know, like I remember one of the very first ones I did was I decided that I was going to go out trick-or-treating on October 19th just to beat the rush. And I was going to film it and just see what people would give me.
That's funny.
And so that was one of the first. And then they started to get progressively weirder.
And this is before Kaufman, right? This is before you...
Yeah, I was probably about 17, maybe.
And then what happened? What was the next one?
They started to turn into like comedy routines. Like, yeah. I was going to a grocery store and seeing, I don't know, just taking a camera and seeing what would happen.
Yeah.
And then making videos and things like that.
Were you having a good time?
It was just fun.
Did you have a crew?
No, there was one other guy, a friend of mine named Brendan Snegus, that we would do a lot of these videos Snegus? Together. Yes, yeah, Snegus.
How's he doing?
He's great. I saw him recently. I hadn't seen him in like 20-something years.
Good name.
Yeah. A good dude.
Oh, good.
He went into social work. He's a great guy.
Good. That's noble profession.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but very, very funny
guy.
And
you saw him back in Kansas?
I saw him back in Kansas, yeah.
That's great.
And
did you go to a reunion or something?
I did. We used to have, there was a radio show in our school. There was like a little radio booth,
uh-huh.
and you could play music.
Uh-huh.
And I remember for a Secret Santa once, I got a dolphin that had just a horrible squeaking sound.
Yeah.
And we locked the doors. We named the dolphin Flapjack.
Yeah.
And we thought we were hilarious.
Yeah.
And then just started squeaking it into the microphone and just not stopping. And they couldn't open the door.
Yeah.
And we did it for 10 minutes.
Again, this is pre-Kaufman, pre-being introduced.
But
to
this
Kaufman.
Is, you could see like, you. I had it in, I, it's like, it was just waiting to be discovered.
This amazing propensity to annoy people for long periods of time, relentlessly,
it just,
through repetition.
It just seemed funny.
Yeah. Well, that is funny. Sure. So tells you should be, you know, so you're doing all this stuff.
Yeah, so I'm doing all this stuff, and he had seen my videos and stuff and knew that I did these speech tournaments, and he said, "Have you ever thought about being an actor?"
Yeah.
This is, I go back to this story and I don't know whether or not it's true. I think maybe it is, or maybe I've just said it so much that now I really think it's true. But it seemed to be a bit of a thunderbolt moment where I thought, an actor. His son was an actor in New York. And
The guys. Your neighbors.
My neighbor.
Yeah.
And
so you kind of knew it was possible.
And I think that I started, you know, I started thinking about acting more than just comedy.
Right.
And so then what I do remember feeling when I made the decision to study theater and acting, that I went into it whole hog. I didn't ever waver from it.
Right.
And I feel like I figured that out as you know, like maybe an 18-year-old.
And then you got into the theater program in college?
I did a play in college. I studied theater in college.
Here it comes.
Oh, is that the leaf blower?
Here it comes.
Sounds like an alien ship is about to land.
It's coming.
What if a bunch of leaves just blow in the window smashes?
What if he just keeps going like a Kaufman bit and just comes right behind here and just doesn't shut it off? I think, you know, I never, like, usually, like, I'm trying to, like, I know they come at this time, but I thought we'd get in under the wire, but we'll keep going until, like, we'll just let it
until
be a performance piece.
Yeah.
And then we'll just wait until it goes away.
Yeah.
It's exciting. You know, like, we feel like something's going to happen now. Something's going to happen,
you could,
Paul.
You could maybe even put another, somehow bring up a chord on your computer or something.
Sure.
We can add a layer of a harmonic to it, and it will create an ambient kind of soundscape.
Well, let's do that with our voices.
All right.
Let's hear it. Wait, can we hear it? No, but when it gets close, we'll do it. So you go, you do a play, what, in college before you get into the program?
I did a play. I did a couple of plays in high school. I did a play in college. And then when I was at, I went to the University of Kansas. And then midway through, I'm like, I'm going to go to this theater conservatory, this school. Called,
in Kansas?
In California, called the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
And
you just decided.
I just decided.
Why on that one?
Seemed like they had a pretty impressive alumni list.
Oh.
That was it.
So you were festering about it. You're like, I got to get out and do this.
I thought, well, if I'm going to do this,
yeah.
I need to go there because that's where everybody goes.
Right.
And I didn't really research other schools.
Yeah.
I was just like, all right, this seems good. I knew somebody else that was auditioning for that school, a friend of mine.
But you had to audition.
You had to audition. I got in. And but I never even visited. The first day I even saw it was the first day that I went to school there.
You just all in.
I just decided. I just decided.
Yeah, that's all right.
I don't know if it's all right, but it's what it's.
Well, what do you get caught up in? Like, I'm going to try to get into Yale, and so you know you got in. Go, it's acting.
Yeah,
you're trying to go to Juilliard, Carnegie Mellon.
Don't think I didn't have that after the fact. Kind of, I should have looked at Yale, and I should have looked at Carnegie Mellon. I should have looked at Juilliard because it seemed like, oh, those are the places.
Those would have killed you.
I doubt I would have.
Juilliard sounds miserable.
I think maybe it might have been. I have friends who went to Juilliard and loved it.
Yeah, how they doing career-wise?
A couple of them are doing okay.
Okay, good.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think that now that I have a little bit of, I can look back in the rearview mirror.
You did all right for yourself?
I started thinking.
Ant-Man?
This is the thing about acting schools. They're all going to teach you how to ride an ant. You're exposed to plays. Yeah. You're always reading plays and working on scenes. And ultimately, that's it.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Yeah. Well, that's what you do.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the good part. I mean, you're reading plays and you're working on scenes.
Yeah. And you learn. For me, there were certain things in acting school that I was like, what the fuck is this? Where we'll all lie down on the ground, close our eyes, and now we have to act like the color green and get up and do it. And I remember even starting off, I was doing it all, but thinking, what? If all of my friends walked into this class right now and saw this, and all my friends were not actors.
If Brendan came in, Brendan was there.
Brendan, they all just started making fun of it so much. And yet, there were certain things in school, tangible things that I could hold on to that made a lot of sense.
Practical
things. Like, I had a teacher named Diana Stevenson who was great.
Yeah.
And she said, here's a good way to memorize your lines. Write them out. Don't say them, write them.
Yeah.
If you're working on a scene and you also have to look at the other people's lines.
Yeah.
So you read those so you know what your response will be and then you start writing it out. Well, it's a great way to memorize things because when you write it out, it gets into your brain in a much deeper way. And then if you mess up, you have to go back and do it again and do it again until you get a word perfect.
Uh-huh. And that worked for you.
That works.
You still do it?
That also, I do.
Yeah.
When I'm doing a play, I do.
Yeah.
There's something very tangible about that. And,
right.
And that kind of stuff, I think.
And applicable.
Yeah. And if you're doing Shakespeare, there are certain rules that you kind of have to follow. And there are certain things you could do, like buy Shakespeare's glossary and go through and figure out what it is you're saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wouldn't have learned that kind of stuff without going to school.
How much Shakespeare have you done?
I don't know. I don't know.
A lot?
I mean, not a lot. A fair amount.
Sure. I mean, but I just don't talk. Like, I talk to a lot of actors, but not everybody has a stage component that seems to go on. Like, you like doing stage.
Well, I liked... I wanted to kind of be... I wanted to have a career that was going to last.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the way to do that is to know your craft a little bit, and the way to learn your craft if you're an actor is to do theater.
Right.
All the actors that I really admired did that.
Yeah.
And so I went in that direction. That's part of why it's a big reason why I moved to New York.
Yeah.
And I still believe that. I still try and do. It's been a few years since I've done a play, but but I also enjoy doing it
too. Yeah. Well, I mean, we were talking sort of glibly and dismissively about the process of acting, but I do think it applies to, you know, maybe movies and TV in terms of like, because you really, it's almost an experiment in blue balls, you know, in terms of like waiting to do a scene, like everything is so disconnected, you know, there's no sort of like narrative through line. Like when you're acting in those things, it is sort of a job because you've got to take everything apart and show up for bits and pieces.
Yeah.
And it's not very satisfying. But I imagine the theater, because it's like you start and then you go to the end.
Right.
And yeah, you got to be in it.
That is a very different sensation. And it's also, it's can be thankless and it's not, I don't know, like the thrill of the stage. That is true. And I know sounds like I'm contradicting myself. But there's something pretty cool when it's clicking and an audience is into it, and there is an exchange of energy.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, if you're telling a joke or if you hear somebody telling a joke and they're telling it really, really well, and there's a kind of a several people around listening to the joke.
Yeah.
And it really lands.
Yeah.
In that buildup to the punchline,
the
air is charged.
Yeah.
And so amplify that by, you know, 1,000 people in a theater.
Yeah.
And what people don't do theater maybe don't realize is just how much energy the people on stage are getting from the audience, where each show feels drastically different based on who's watching. And it's a strange and fascinating feeling to have it work.
Yeah.
And you feel that lightness.
Yeah.
And in that moment, it's really cool.
Yeah.
And then when it's done, it's great because it's like, oh, it's over. It's like a workout.
Yeah, yeah.
You feel great after a workout, but you never really want to go to do the workout.
Right, right.
Sometimes I feel that doing a play.
Yeah, yeah. No, I feel it about, you know, comedy. I feel, in a place. I talked to Harbour, David Harbour. He's so funny. He's talking about, you know, not stage fright, but just panic in general.
Yeah.
Like, and he just had this, like, he told this story about, like, he'd be like, you know, he's in a major play and like he's about ready to make his entrance and he's like, oh, fuck it. Somebody give me a script. Like, you know, like,
yeah, I know that feeling so well. Like, yeah, what am I supposed to say? Because it is a little bit of,
it's
you
like
know,
all
whatever you do for the next 10 seconds, don't think of a pink elephant.
Right, right.
You know, you're
right,
going
exactly,
to.
Exactly, right.
It's like, whatever you do, you're going to go on stage in front of, you know, all this many people. Whatever you do, don't forget your lines.
Right,
oh,
right.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
I don't
know
any of them. I don't know any of them.
Yeah, it sucks. It's terror. It's terror.
Has that ever happened where you don't know your shit?
I have had moments on stage where it's like blank, or I start thinking two or three lines ahead.
Oh, right.
Where you're in the middle of a run and you've done, you know, 50 performances already, and so you can kind of you know everybody's lines,
right?
And in those moments, you can think, oh, all right, what's three lines ahead? Like you just for a second you get out of it, you take yourself out of it.
I know this
too
is.
Long, and then you're like, oh. Oh God! Oh my God! Oh my God! And a momentary, oh, it's the worst feeling in the world. And you just look into the eyes of whoever's on stage with you, and
they know.
And they know. And I feel like something kicks in them where they just they go into full on safety net mode.
Right. Right.
Or. What's really bad is if they get what you got, and then
you're both lost.
And then you're both lost. That's terrible.
And the audience doesn't know.
Well, that's the other thing. Audiences never know.
Yeah.
The
terror that you're going through.
The terror, or if you mess up. I mean, any actor that has done a play, people come back afterward and you say, oh my God, I can't believe you're in that moment. You guys saw it when I did this, and this. And they're like, what? No.
It's great. We loved it.
Yeah, we had no idea that. We're just so egotistical that we assume everyone is really dissecting what it is that we're doing.
It's true. They're thinking about themselves. And
everybody's thinking about themselves always.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were talking about comedy and about what's interesting to me, like a lot of times, is just people's timing. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, some people have timing and some people don't. And like, I think there's a lot in terms of what makes me laugh and just like, just the timing of it. Like, it, I mean, yeah, sometimes timing, you don't even know what was said. It was just said just at the right moment.
The musicality of something, and you know, it's, you like the music, you like a certain band because of the way they sound.
Right.
The way they put their rhythms together.
Right. But you have good timing, you have good comedic timing, and it's always great to see you. But I was thinking about that. I guess like your movie career, I know you did a lot of TV here and there, but the Wet Hot American Summer was sort of this big cult hit.
Yeah.
Did that sort of land you on the radar of things, or was it before that?
No, I think it was, that was, there are certain things that have kind of, I look back and think, oh, this was a, this was important in a lot of ways.
Uh-huh.
And Wet Hot American Summer was something that, when I read it, I was, oh my God, I love this so much.
Yeah.
And I knew David, I knew those guys.
From where?
Well, I watched The State.
Yeah. You
know, and so I knew who they were.
Right.
And I had become friends with them by the time we started making that film.
Yeah.
But I had worked on Romeo and Juliet, you know, with the Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes.
Oh,
I was in that, and there was another guy in that named Zach Orth. Zach is also—
I know Zach.
Yeah, so you know Zach. And
I don't know him, but I've—
He's great.
Yeah.
And he lived in New York.
Yeah.
And I lived in New York, and so we became friends on that film. And then when we got back to Manhattan, he said, you know, my buddies are doing this play called Sex, a.k.a. Wieners and Boobs. And it was Showalter and Joe Latrullio and a lot of those guys. And so I went to go see it and loved it. And then David said, look, we have this script. We're trying to make this movie. And I was like, oh, my God. Well, this is kind of the first thing I've ever read or that seemed like it kind of spoke to my own sense of humor. You know, everything was kind of— every comedy you'd ever read was like, all right, that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
But not like this.
Yeah.
And so that was the feeling in making it that everyone got the joke.
Yeah.
Everyone was friends.
Right.
And everybody kind of, even midway through, I remember Zach saying to me, I don't know if this will ever come out. I just want to have a videotape of it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I know what you mean. And so I think because of that movie, in the comedy world, people saw it and liked it.
Yeah.
And it certainly played a part in me getting the role in Anchorman, which was certainly a kind of sea change, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's— I think it's time for the interlude.
Yeah.
We got to do one of these, like...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's coming. I could have done it longer, and I laughed. Damn it. And I feel bad breaking it because it's going against what I instinctually want to do.
So you feel like
I could do this for another 45 minutes.
Right. Your instinct is to like, let's just end this way, but keep doing it for an hour.
Keep doing it. Yeah, for an hour. And I'm knocked up on the movie Knocked Up.
Yeah.
There was a scene where Seth Rogen and I are in Las Vegas, and during that shoot, it was like 4 days in Las Vegas.
Right.
other guys in the cast like, came out, and we were all going out to Las Vegas as a in a group. We were like going to go to some like a club, and then do go around and like something that none of us really are the guys to do that. But we're like, this is what you're going to do.
And
I think early on, I made a joke. I was on my cell phone saying, pretending I was calling Treat Williams and like, hey, Treat, yeah, what's up? Oh yeah, man, come out, yeah, we're hitting, we're going to Rain. And I made some joke that was, it wasn't really funny, and I realized the only way to make it funny is to just keep talking to him, and all night, and
you can treat.
I was just talking, laughing, and just talking to Treat Williams for about 3 hours or so, 3.5 hours.
Really?
No, I wasn't talking to anybody.
Were you getting the reaction to it?
No. The guys were just like, and every few minutes they'd look over and they'd laugh, saying, "Wow, you're sticking with this."
Yeah,
and I think they had an appreciation that I was sticking with it, especially because we then went to a few different places and I never engaged in any of the conversation. I just only pretended to be talking to Treat Williams. Then we went back to a casino and everyone sat at a blackjack table, but you're not allowed to talk on a cell phone instead of the blackjack table. So I stood behind them and didn't play and just kept laughing and pretending to talk to Treat Williams. And the whole night out, I never engaged in anything, only just talked to Treat Williams. And so that is the equivalent of.
Hold on. Where is he?
And now that I've called attention to it, I feel like I can't I can't continue the length of this. But what made me break it in the first place was wondering if somebody was listening to this, and do you think either one, that woke him up, or two, put him to sleep,
or made him go like, "This is fucking ridiculous."
I think maybe the majority said, "All right, fast forward
enough." Right?
Yeah.
We don't even know if my producer's going to leave it in.
No.
I think he should. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'll make note. I say I think it's important to me and Paul that you play.
At least. If your producer decides to cut it, at least we have to let the people know we did it for a really long time.
Yeah, you did it. I felt at some point during one of those runs that you were like, how long can I do this for without taking a breath?
That's right.
You challenge yourself.
Yeah, and the only way you can do it is if you go really, really deep.
And go and not release a lot of air.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, exactly. I'll see how long I can do that. This has to be the most boring thing you've ever done with anybody at the desk.
I've never done it.
No, me either.
I'm just glad you broke because I got to that point where I'm like, am I going to pass out to try to win this?
It was
so Judd Apatow.
Yeah.
Changed everything.
Yeah.
Anchorman.
Huge thing there.
And then he became like sort of a Judd Apatow surrogate in a way. Like you played his vision of himself twice, didn't you? Would it be like in This Is 40?
This Is 40 and then Knocked Up, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that relationship is, are you guys friends? Do you have an understanding?
Oh, yeah, friends. I saw him 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I see him at the Comedy Store now a lot.
Yeah.
He's fun, right?
I love him.
Yeah.
He's great. The whole family is great. And it was and is a very unique experience to kind of act opposite his wife and daughters with him in the room.
That is wild.
It's kind of weird.
He trusts you.
I think he does. Yeah. I think he
trusts you to be him.
Well, Yeah, I think he does.
Yeah.
I remember before we did This Is 40, he's like, come on over and just hang out at the house and see what our life is like.
Uh-huh.
And like, I remember like going with him, like putting the girls to bed. It's creepy.
The two of you?
Yeah. They're kind of thinking about this.
And how'd the girls react? Were they?
I think that they were just, all right. Yeah, they already knew who I was.
Right.
You know, ever since they were little, they knew who I was. But
yeah.
I don't know. They were probably already used to so much weirdness in their life that had to do with the movie business.
Yeah. And now the old man's back doing comedy talking about him. This is what they needed.
Yeah.
Yeah. and the David Wayne and Showalter, you know, all you've sort of grown up with them too, right?
Yeah.
You've done a lot of their movies.
Yeah. And still really close with
that whole community.
That whole crowd. Yeah.
Joe lives around here.
I know. Like, in Don Knotts' old house.
Does he really?
Yeah, that's Don Knotts'
house. Oh, I had no idea. Yeah. I've not been over there. I ran into his wife at an event. I saw them at the award show. And I know, like, it's one of those things like, hey, we should all like, yeah, well, maybe that. I don't know if that's going to happen.
Oh, well,
I'd like to. But I like, you have
I'm
to
sure
sort
he
of,
would too.
I know, but like, how do you do that as grown-ups? I got to figure out how to do that.
It's harder as grown-ups. It's harder when you're married. It's harder if you have kids.
And it's sort of like, you know, we're not, you know, we've sort of known each other just in passing.
Right.
So like, let's try the new friend thing.
And
have a dinner.
And you two would be total chums.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like him. He's been in here.
Yeah.
In the old garage.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw you in Duncan Jones's movie. That was the interesting turn. Like you need to do a few more movies where you're just a completely horrendous person.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, I liked it, a lot of it. You know, I thought it was an interesting movie, and I thought that the riff on the original... Who was the other guy? Was it Justin
Theroux? Theroux,
yeah. That the riff on the original MASH was odd.
Yeah. So, yeah,
to make those characters horrible.
Really weird.
Yeah.
And to put them in that movie in the future in Berlin. It was so... When I read it, I was like, huh?
Yeah.
And I met Duncan, who I... really like
and
think is a really talented filmmaker, but he's the one that kind of explained it to me, and I thought, well, I want to go along for this ride. It seems like it's a weird one.
Well, I thought that it was I was sort of surprised that, you know, sort of like you're one of these guys that we've all grown to know and love in terms of the range that you've made available in the movies, right? The comedies. Like, you know, we've seen you sad and happy and whatever, but we haven't seen you menacing necessarily. And, you know, like, it's funny because you enter it, like, I'm watching, I'm like, oh, look, it's cute Paul Rudd. And then you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Awful person.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, but you turn, like when you get evil, you're like, no, he can do that.
It would be nice to do it more often.
Right.
I don't think people necessarily think of me for things like that, nor... maybe want to see me in things like that.
But isn't that interesting? People, they know what you know. You have a marketable quality that's worked for you for many years, and you know, and obviously it's a big part of who you are. But you know, you are an actor,
right?
But so does that get frustrating?
Yeah, at times.
Yeah, and have you tried to do things that
I have? And you know, sometimes they're the right things, and sometimes they're not.
Yeah.
I've been offered throughout the years things that were like dramatic roles, but I just didn't really connect with them.
Right.
I don't want to do something dramatic or play a bad guy for the sake of playing a bad guy. It has to be the right thing.
Yeah.
And I've done it in plays more than movies or anything like that. But it can be a little frustrating, but that's, you know, at the same time, to complain about certain things seems a little...
No, I get it. But like, what I mean, it's got to be available to you in a small movie, an indie movie, where it's just a matter of, I would imagine having discussions with a director like you must have had with Duncan, where, you know, it's sort of who would want you to play against type.
Yeah. I mean, every once in a while I meet a filmmaker who does.
Yeah.
I think in the right thing, it can be an effective thing.
Sure.
People have a preconceived notion
of who
I am.
Right.
But I never really... had the kind of purposeful decision making that said, I'm going to do something dramatic because I just did a comedy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to switch it up and really, and maybe I should have.
No.
But I didn't really and don't really think in that way.
Yeah.
I think more in terms of, wow, I really like this. A lot of comedies, I read and I was like, these are really fun. I think they'd be fun to work on. I love the people and was with people I'd worked with many times.
Yeah.
And in truth, that is really what I probably enjoy the most.
Yeah. Why fuck that up?
I don't know. Yeah. These are also, at the end of the day, it's a movie.
Right.
So who gives a shit? Nobody cares. It's not that important. Anyway, 99% kind of the world doesn't care at all.
Is that true?
I think so. But
some things are memorable.
Well, absolutely.
You know, some movies, like, they change lives.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. And they had enough of an impact on me that they changed my life. Look at what I want to do for a living.
Right.
But.
Like, my girlfriend, I'm like, I'm going to interview Paul Rudd. And she's like, well, who is he again? And I said, well, you know, he's in the Judd Apatow. Oh, the one who was looking at the hemorrhoid on his own asshole?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, yeah, that guy. It's like, oh, that was funny. Oh, so
there we go. I changed your girlfriend's life.
You're that guy.
I'm that guy. So anyway, what I was going to say is that, you know, you see a movie and it's 2 hours. You don't like it. You can walk out.
Right.
But when you're making it, it's months on end and you're in it. And so the experience, I have certainly done it enough now for a long enough time that the experience of working on something counts a lot.
Yeah.
And
sure.
I want to enjoy it.
Yeah. It's like, it's half a year of your life sometimes. Yeah. Right. When you do that, do you usually have the kids over or what do they do?
No, I mean, normally I'll travel back on weekends.
Right, right, right.
I mean, a lot of the Marvel stuff has been shooting in Georgia, and because I live in New York, it's really easy.
Not too bad. Yeah.
It's not too bad. If it's during the summer,
yeah,
I will, they'll come with me if, you know, but they got their lives now.
Sure,
and that's honestly like the hardest part of this whole job.
Is being away from the kids?
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet. Well, good luck with the movie.
Thank you.
What are you shooting something now? You got something coming up that, you know, you want to break news?
No, I got no news to break.
You just you're going to do the Ant-Man publicity and then have a summer or what?
Yeah, which is going to take up a big chunk of the summer.
You just starting it?
When's just
it
starting?
It opens when?
July 6th.
Oh, yeah. So you got a couple of weeks, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And then it comes out later in Europe because
you got to go over there right after?
Yeah.
You still have family in England?
I do.
Oh, well, yeah. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Do you see them?
Yeah, I'll see them. I'm only going to be there for about 2 days, but I'm going to see them. Yeah.
All right, buddy. Well, it was. I'm glad we got to do this finally.
Yeah, me too.
And we had a good. We did some experimental stuff.
Yeah,
yes.
I like it. We made an ambient soundtrack.
Yeah, we did a lot of things here today.
We really did.
Yeah,
I feel you've really we've run ourselves through the ringer.
Let's just go to Joe Truglia's house and knock on the door.
Yeah,
and go like, hey, look,
hey, we're here. Tell us about Don Knotts. Did you find anything in the attic?
Oh, Don Knotts. All right. Lovely man, just as expected. Lovely person, that Paul Rudd fella. Glow on Netflix is up. Second season 2 is on now. Okay? I'll play some guitar. I'm playing sloppier guitar. I'm playing more distorted guitar because, I don't know, it's satisfying. You know, the action on this guitar is way too high, and I don't know what happened, if it bowed or what, but I got to bring it in to get fixed, but... strings are old, but why can't I just keep up? Do I need a guitar tech for my hobbying? Is that what I fucking need? A guitar tech for my hobbying? Am I at that point in my career?
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.